joining us today on the Periodic Bagel is Scott Bagley. Scott is a senior principal scientist and synthesis lab head of inflammation and immunology at Pfizer Global Research and Development in Groton, Connecticut. He has a bachelor's in chemistry from Bucknell University. Welcome, Scott.
Thanks, guys. Really glad to be here.
An extremely serious question here for you, Scott, which is, what is the best pizza in Connecticut?
Oh, gosh. Okay. So down here where I live, we're pretty close to Mystic. And so Mystic Pizza is a pretty big famous one. And you might all remember the movie with Julie Roberts.
Is that the same Mystic Pizza?
It is absolutely the same Mystic Pizza. Yep. The actual filming location was somewhere down, was in the next town over, but yeah, it's the same place. I wouldn't say it's my fave, no. There's other ones in town I like a little bit better. In Connecticut overall, I think I will honestly have to say I've never had it, but everybody talks about this one's in New Haven. Trying to remember the name, tell you the truth, you stumped me on that one. I've never been, but all the folks that have been in New Haven just love that pizza down there.
Pepe's?
Pepe's, yes, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, it's supposed to be amazing. And, I will have to say that also that I hate to say, but Alex is a bit right on this one. Jersey pizza is my fave. Yeah, just in general.
I don't know that I've actually made the claim myself that Jersey pizza is my fave, but I do appreciate the New Jersey government Twitter account, and they say it's their fave. So I'm born in Jersey, so I'm happy to roll.
What is New Jersey pizza? I regret I do not know this.
When I lived down there right after school, I spent a few years working at Merck before I came here to Pfizer, and had a few fantastic pizza places down there in the Rahway area. One of them was a place called Townhouse in Rahway. I think it's still there. I haven't been back in a really long time, but it's super thin, crispy crust, just so greasy, so so bad for you, but just amazing. And I know a lot of people are sitting there going, no, Chicago, New York, Boston, whatever, you know, but... I hear you. They're all good. Pizza in general is its own food group, it's probably my fave down there.
Is pizza a taco, a sandwich, or both?
Ooh, I may be an open-faced quesadilla. depends how you eat it. I suppose if you roll it up, you could call it a taco. I mean, I've seen some really interesting things that people have put inside of pizzas, rolled up pizzas. I saw a picture of a hot dog rolled up in a pizza once. Interesting. But yeah, I think I'm not sure pizza is a sandwich. Calzone, absolutely. But yeah.
My man. Okay, so before we dive deeper into the interview, I kind of want to address the pandemic in the room.
Of course.
And I think like we haven't talked about it yet. We haven't touched on it. I think this is actually the first episode that we recorded before the pandemic broke out. And I think I just want to talk about it once, get it done with, and then go back to, I think what comes to mind is CJ, whenever a recession is coming up or whenever there's something recession related, you have a code word for it. And I think it stems from The West Wing.
Yes,
you call it a
that
bagel.
Is true.
and because no one likes to hear the word recession and invite the fate. So I was wondering if maybe there's a code word that we could have if we ever want to address the fact that, yeah, we're living through a pandemic right now, and then just not touch on it ever again. What can that word be?
I don't know. You got to feel bad for the makers of Corona beer because, you know, it's been destroyed. It's got to be nobody's ever going to be able to drink Corona. They're going to have to change the name to something else.
To be honest, it was never really a good beer in the first place.
I suspect that Corona is much more a beer that's part you have a Corona at the beach with your friends and you're not really caring about necessarily the taste of the beer.
It's a vehicle for wine.
I think absolutely. And it is kind of weird that first off, hats off to all the folks out there who are living through this day to day, 24 hours a day, taking care of folks, all the people who are out there delivering our Amazon orders and such and groceries and everything. please be well, everybody. But it's kind of funny. We're still living down here in Southeast Connecticut. You know, it's lime season down here.
Lime disease.
Oh.
So it's it's kind of, you know, this kind of, this time of year, all the ticks come out. Corona and lime, it's not a good mix.
Oh man. All right. So let's move on from the pandemic. We're never going to talk about it again here on the
That's
Periodic
right.
Bagel. If it does come up, we're going to call it
the milkshake.
Yeah.
It's milkshake season.
So let's move on to our quiz. CJ put together the quiz. But I think it actually stems from one of our common interests, me and you, Scott. We're both into motorcycles. CJ came up with a motorcycle-related quiz, specifically about a particular motorcycle gang, the Hells Angels.
So, Scott, what are the big four motorcycle clubs?
You know, I've been waiting for this quiz ever since you guys started doing this. I was like, this is absolutely 100% not what I thought you guys would be asking about. let's see. Beyond the Sam Crow, right, in real life, let's see, Hells Angels, Mongols, Outlaws, and some other guys in leather vests. Those are the ones that I got.
And which one are you a member of?
We actually have a bunch of riders at Pfizer. One of them calls us the SOPs, the Sons of Pfizer. I like to call us colleagues riding at Pfizer. just a few guys hanging out sometimes, going out for rides and stuff. I'll have to say, I met Alex at the NOS this past year before I knew he was at Alex F. Goldberg. But just before the NOS, some friends of mine and I drove up to Laconia on the bikes for Bike Week, and they actually had a Hells Angels like tent where they were selling stuff.
Were they selling guns and drugs?
It was like T-shirts and memorabilia, really.
So perfectly legal memorabilia.
So, Scott,
you went too far there.
That gets to question number four, which is true or false. The Hells Angels have sued Zappos.
Huh. That's so random. It's got to be true.
Yep, it is true. It's all about the logo, right? And they were selling, I think it was a ring and a purse. And the lawyer representing the Hells Angels claimed, "This isn't just about money. It's about membership. If you've got one of these rings on, a member might get really upset that you're an imposter."
Oh,
nice.
Question number five, which is true or false, the Hells Angels have sued Toys R Us.
Okay, that one, yeah, I can't see that. I'm going to say no, but you're going to tell me it's something crazy like some kind of, they sold a onesie that said Baby Angels or something.
That was my nickname in high school.
It's true. They were selling yo-yos that had the Death Head logo. Hells Angels asserted that the mark used on the yo-yos is likely to confuse the public into mistakenly believing that the toys originate with the Hells Angels. So the case settled, hopefully not outside with fists and other things, but the case settled.
In the parking lot with chains and
whips. That's right.
How we do things. Us motorcycle guys.
That's right.
Sure. What is the country to first ban the Hells Angels?
Oh, first ban.
Guess the continent.
Alex, I'm thinking it's Canada, but I have no idea.
No, it's actually it's the Netherlands. Presiding judge of the court in Utrecht called it a danger to public order and the rule of law, which, I mean, fair.
You have to wonder, like, what consists of a danger to public order in the Netherlands? And, you know, I guess Hells Angels is a pretty good candidate, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they are pretty permissive on other things, so... Yeah, I don't know. some members wear a patch with the initials AFFA. What does it stand for?
Ooh.
It's you know, not the Swedish fan.
We've seen some documentaries on them and stuff like that on TV and stuff, but I absolutely have no idea.
It's Angels Forever, Forever Angels. Not to be confused with Angels in the Outfield.
No, no, absolutely not.
Although I'd watch that crossover movie, you know, Hell's Angels playing baseball.
That would be pretty good.
So what are the levels of Hell's Angels? Is it A, senior principal, research fellow, and senior research fellow? B, assistant, associate, full, and emeritus? C, hang around, associate, prospect, and full patch? Or D, ace men, rocket men, and rank and file?
It's C.
Yes, it is C.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yep. Associate professor.
You learned that in one of the first episode of Sons or any other show about Hell's Angels on TV or anything like that. Absolutely.
The SOPs.
Yes, so, SOPs, yes.
All I can think of right now is hashtag alt chem jobs. Okay, so CJ, how about I take number 8 and you take number 9 here?
Sure. Actually, I think it should be the other way around.
You'll see why in a second. Okay, so number 8, true or false? There was a great Ontario biker war of 1994.
Again, I think probably true.
Close. It was a Quebec biker war. It was a violent turf war that began in 1994, continued to 2002 in Montreal. War began as the Hells Angels in Quebec began to make a push to establish a monopoly on street-level drug sales in the province.
call me like extremely naive, but I was not aware. So I'm the person who wrote this question, and like I was not aware of a drug problem in Quebec, but apparently
that is or was like the kind of like the main Canadian pharmaceutical locale, for what it's worth.
Or maybe you should have asked LC about it.
Yeah, we'll get him back on.
That's right.
All right, CJ, why don't you take it from here? Number 9.
What is the best motorcycle sound? Is it brum, 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 brum? Is it meow or is it vroom vroom?
And by the way, Scott, I'll have you know, this was literally my only contribution to the interview questions today.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm really glad that PJ read that out loud.
lots of motorcycle sounds are good. I know when, Alex's sounds like wee, but just kidding. The best sound is probably when you're in. We were at a ride one time. There was about 500 bikes, and they all started up just about at once. It was pretty intense. Also, I have a metric sport cruiser, the 4-cylinder, and the sound of that winding up on ramp on the way to work is probably my favorite. Yeah.
That's nice. Pretty awesome. So you ride your motorcycle into work?
Sure, sure.
Oh, okay.
Most of the year if I can. And it's not that far. Sometimes on a nice day, I'll go out, take an extra 10 minutes and ride around a little bit before I get in.
When I lived in Edmonton, I had a pair of winter riding gloves for like April and October. And then when I moved down to San Francisco, it was like the end of December in 2017. And I gave my winter gloves to my colleague who I sold a bike to, thinking that, you know, I'm moving to San Francisco, I'm never going to need, you know, cold weather gloves again. And turns out, like, you can still kind of get frostbite when you're driving on the freeway and it's, you know, low 50s and early in the morning. And so I end up having to buy a new pair. All right. So let's dig into you yourself a bit more, Scott. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure thing. So I grew up outside of Boston. I have to credit my mom with my interest in chemistry. Her family's originally from Nova Scotia. They came to Boston. My grandmother came to Boston and my mom sent my mom to school for chemistry. My mom's got a BS in chemistry, and so she didn't push chemistry on me per se, but there was always science in the house. And about the time I got into high school, she had started a job at a local high school teaching chemistry. So it was always around the house. I have a bunch of brothers and sisters, and they're all in like accounting and a couple of MBAs and stuff like that. But so I was the only one that really picked up the science. Wanted to be a pre-med first, I think. And then in high school, I got some biochemistry, and realized that chemistry was where I wanted to be. After high school, got into Bucknell. They had a really nice program there, and got my BS in 1989. Was thinking about juggling the idea of grad school or working, and we had had some folks from pharma come and give lectures, and it really struck me that I wanted to do that. And at the time, I was kind of tired of school and didn't really feel like, you know, that I really wanted to continue to have more, I guess, formal education, or like in chemistry. I didn't want to jump right into grad school. I just wanted to get out and sort of test the waters and see what it's like. And I also thought, you know, having a job, earning some money was going to be where I wanted to be. And so I was fortunate enough to get an interview with Merck, and they hired me, which was just such a great feeling. And started there. I was as green as you can be. At the NOS this year, we honored Professor Buchwald. And one of the stories that made me think of was when in school, and this was basically where the state of the chemistry was at the time. One of my professors said, oh, this palladium chemistry, it's a black box. We'll never figure out what's going on. And, you know, so, you know, I was probably 2 years into my career at Merck before I even saw boronic acid. I went, what the heck is this thing? You know, so it was the breadth of chemistry that's come out in the last, you know, 20, 25 years is just absolutely ridiculous. It was all about wanting to give it a shot, and you know, people would work for a couple of years and some of them would go back to school. Sometimes you'd see them later on, come back as a PhD. But, you know, I kind of liked what I was doing. I really enjoyed it. And, never really, after that, entertained a lot of thoughts of going back to school, and just stayed at it with the goal of someday putting my name, you know, or being part of a team that made a drug. And, well, still working on that. So,
yeah.
How did you get your job at Merck? Like, what was the process for you in doing that?
A few companies came up to school. You know, Bucknell is in central Pennsylvania, not too far from, you know, one of the big chemistry hubs at the time was Northern Jersey.
Right.
And so they sent people from a bunch of different companies to come up and put your name in. And there was only about 12 to 14 chemistry majors at Bucknell in my graduating class. And you know, they basically interviewed all of us. I would say I was probably the only one that was really hardcore organic. There were physical chemists and so, yeah, I just got a couple of callbacks. And at one point, you know, thinking about how things change, I was, I called up the number I had for the guy that had come to visit from Merck and said, you know, I haven't heard from you guys in a while. Anything going on? He's like, oh yeah, we meant to call you. We're gonna set you up with an interview. They gave me a date and everything. I'm like, okay, that's awesome. You know, so about 5 minutes later, we're walking down to lunch, and I open up my mailbox down in the university center, and there's a letter, you know, with a job offer from another company. And seriously, in, you know, 5 minutes, I would never have called Merck back, which I thought was like. You know, this huge coincidence that I would have probably just taken that other job and said thank you very much, and things would have been 1,000 times different.
What was the other? Can you tell us?
The other company was American Cyanamid, which ended up being part of Letterly, and then Wyeth, and now part of Pfizer. So hey, yeah. You never know. I could have been right back here.
What was Merck interviewing like at that time? Was it like, was it pop quizzes, or was it just, you know, a series of introductions and questions?
I spent almost an entire day kind of wandering around, meeting with somebody every hour or so, maybe every half an hour.
Yeah.
And each person was completely different. You might have somebody who just kind of chats you up and say like, hey, you know, you play softball. we're looking for people for our team. you know, then some of the people were quizzing me about things that, you know, I had done some summer research at Bucknell one summer. And, you know, what did you do there? What'd you learn? Kind of stuff like that. It's just there was no presentation. There was no, nothing really, nothing formal like that. Kind of see how you fit. I think part of that is that time from about the late 80s through the late 90s. It was such a hiring binge in pharma. It was a lot of just, can we get some people in the lab? I mean, looking back on me now, you know, looking back on what I knew when I got there, I was, like I said, so green. I mean, I walked in there and went, what is this stuff I'm looking at? Because all I knew was the undergraduate labs. And, you know, you make aspirin or you make, you know, butyl acetate or something.
Right.
And a little bit of summer research I did was not MedChem related. It was a whole new experience. And thinking about, you know, listening to the podcast you guys have done so far, Derek Lowe touched on this about sort of like your network. Mm-hmm. And I cannot stress that enough. He mentioned like when you're in, you know, you're in pharma and you want to meet your biologist and toxicologist and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I had that, but when I got to Merck, I was absolutely lucky enough to have a few people there who I knew from Bucknell. In fact, one of my lab TAs worked in the next lab over. And that was just so important for me to have somebody to help, to confide with, to guide me. I mean, I had a great boss at the time, but it was just, you know, getting in the lab and looking around going, you know, right off the bat, I don't even know where anything is, let alone what are you doing? You know, learning the reactions, learning the chemistry as I went. You know, here's a recipe, just go do it, you know, come back to me when you're done. And as far as, you know, I had no real training in, you know, how to take a molecule apart or how to put one together. It was, you know, so just being able to sort of reach out to the folks that I knew there and talk to them and learn chemistry in the lab, you know, it took a few years to really get comfortable in my own skin there.
And so, I mean, you mentioned that, having good mentors and building out a good network were really critical for the early stages of your career and probably like still now. What other advice would you have for young, maybe BS, MS level chemists or undergraduate students even?
Sure. I mean, when I look at my own chemical education, you know, I feel like it's, you know, it's maybe a little bit heretical, but, you know, I feel like for me, a lot of chemistry is a toolbox. You know, I don't necessarily think about it. You know, I've come a long way in the chemistry that I know and I understand. But I have to actually make sure that, you know, I think about why something works as opposed to, okay, here's A to B. And how does all the A to Bs and the C to Ds fit together? One of the best places to learn that is from the experts around you. Wherever you, whatever company you're in, everybody around you is an expert in something. You know, find out what those people know. Find out who they are. Get to know them. Just drop in and say, I saw that you were working on this. What can you tell me about that? You know, I'm looking to do this kind of reaction. What are the subtleties that you know you need to know to do this effectively? A lot of companies have quarterly reports that they put out about different projects that they're working on. Or at Pfizer, we had this beautiful online journal that was run out of our sandwich site. It was called Synthon. That was kind of like what's going on in almost every project. People were encouraged to write up a few times a year kind of what they're doing, almost like in a little Tetlet kind of format. And the greatest thing about that is that not only was it like specific for what we do at Pfizer, it was, you could call the people, you could see what worked and what didn't, which was, I thought, the most valuable bit. You know, that connection you could make with the people on the ground in the labs and just just being able to reach out and say, what are you doing? I see what you're doing here. I've got something similar. Can you help me?
It sounds like you benefited from not only your own kind of entrepreneurial drive, seeking people out, but also benefited from resources made available to you by your organization.
Absolutely.
Those two things combined were really beneficial.
I wouldn't say I had been doing this job. I've been at Pfizer now 27 years, about 30 years altogether. And I wouldn't say I really had, you know, what one would consider formal chemistry education. You know, I didn't go to grad school. I had my undergrad, and then everything else I've learned has been on the job from the work that I do, the work that goes on all around me. And it's just, you know, be a sponge, just absolutely be a sponge and ask questions.
What kind of barriers would you say you face, given that you didn't go to grad school? Do you find that has created challenges for you in your career?
You know, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think in the beginning, you know, you're in a job that's populated and sort of most of the leaders are, you know, have a PhD. There were times when you felt like there was sort of kids table and adult table, like a Thanksgiving, trying to sort of break through into that. At times it's extremely difficult, and it's probably one of the harder things about the job. When you're starting as a VS, obviously there's a knowledge gap, and you're relying on somebody with you know, higher up the ladder to guide you and show you where you're trying to go. I think the biggest challenge for me was I wanted to get to that point and sort of just where I could, you know, be part of that decision-making process. As a BS chemist, you're kind of promoted on what you've done. Whereas I believe someone who has a PhD is brought in with a level of potential.
Right.
You know, and so things take a little longer. So when I was promoted to the level of an incoming PhD, I probably had about, I think it's 14 or 15 years in as an associate chemist. You know, it was a big deal because it kind of said, yeah, okay, you know, you can do this. You know, I mentioned before the networking and the reaching out thing. The other thing is finding, you know, getting in a great position. I had a wonderful boss at Pfizer for the first 9 years of my career. The gentleman who took over responsibility of me, you know, he knew that I was doing a pretty good job. But what I really credit him with was just letting the leash out. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. He just said, you take this on, you show me what you can do. And that was like the best thing ever. I mean, finding yourself.
That was really empowering.
It was great. I mean, my wife and I were, you know, we were just married at the time. And she said to me previously, she's like, something happened to you. Yeah. She's like, all of a sudden you went from a job to a career.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And it was right about that time. I mean, it wasn't like I loved doing chemistry, you know, but when at that point, when I was, you know, kind of able to just hit the ground running and take on a job and just go, you know, I will be forever in that. And that guy, Dave, in his debt for, you know, allowing me that chance. Because it was, you know, like I said, my wife even noticed that. She's like, what happened? And it was really just that huge impact of having the right boss at the right time and just allowing me to know, you know, to understand and take you under his wing and just go.
I'm really curious because, you know, both Alex and I are more on the process side. So you really wanted to participate in the decision making or make your own decisions. What specifically does that mean?
At the time, it was about how to get to, you know, certain sets of targets. How can you make, you know, dozens of compounds at the same time. What are the strategies about how you get?
So it wasn't so much which targets, but which chemistry.
Which chemistry? Yeah. That being said, in chemistry, when you're thinking about the chemistry that you're doing, then and the target you're going after, if you don't know why, then it doesn't matter. You need to know why, because if you're proposing things or looking at chemistry that's going to say you have a phenyl ring and you want to go off the meta position, you know, why are you doing that? What are the structures you're trying to get at? What's the med chem rationale for what you're trying to get to? So that training has been, you know, was there the whole time. You're learning it the whole time. And so being able to combine, okay, if you put this group here, how is that going to affect your, you know, your potency, your SAR, of course. And so if you're not bringing that along too, then it's a chemistry really isn't going to get you anywhere. You're going to go down a lot of rabbit holes. So it's a whole bunch of all of that together.
Getting back to what we were talking about earlier, in terms of like developing associate level chemists, I think like I've seen that as well, where, you know, I was working with junior level chemists who I think felt like their ideas weren't taken as seriously because of that lack of credential, or felt those kinds of barriers. And so I think the next kind of related question that I'd like to ask is, put yourself back in your early stage shoes, and what advice would you have for those people managing you in terms of being able to enable a junior associate's career development? Like, what are the things that would make that experience a lot better?
That's a great question. You know, we just recently, we hired a number of BS chemists. One of them actually works for me right now. She just started in December. And I tell you, what a time to start. You know, you get December, you cut start in with, we got holiday parties, you got 2 weeks off or so at Christmas and then and New Year's, and then, you know, the milkshake. Thinking back, you know, what would have helped me at the time, you know, getting them involved right off the bat, you know, come to the meetings if you want, getting comfortable with sharing what you're doing, you know, with the broader group, get some FaceTime and really give people the opportunity to stand up and say, this is what I'm doing. And making sure that people aren't afraid to be wrong. It's okay to be wrong.
Yeah.
You know,
if they're sitting in those meetings and aren't necessarily comfortable asking a question there, you know, making time for them afterwards to kind of touch base and, hey, like, did you understand everything that was going on?
Absolutely.
In this particular
meeting?
Yeah.
Now, I mentioned this earlier where, you know, when I came to my first job at Merck, and I was so green, it wasn't even funny. When Alex, you and I, we were at the NOS this year, and a couple nights I was asked to judge posters as part of the organizing committee there. I got a chance to talk to some folks that were teaching undergrads, some really amazing undergrads themselves.
Including Bucknell Professor Mike Kraut, right?
Absolutely. Mike Kraut from Bucknell and a couple of his, three of his students who were, and one of them were on a Pulitzer Prize. And then, but also being involved in the hiring process for the folks that we hired just recently. The level of quality of education at the undergraduate level right now is just spectacular. I mean, huge shout out to anybody out there involved in teaching these kids. They're coming out so prepared, and I, you know, thinking about the things that I learned way back when, you know, that filled up 2 years worth of organic chemistry. And in the same time, these folks are teaching and the kids are learning all of the new chemistry that has come out. It's just amazing that they're able to fit it all in and teach it so these kids understand it and they can, they can use it. And they can, you know, develop, you know, their own, you know, takes on it. And it's just, like I said, we didn't know anything about palladium chemistry. Now there's not only palladium, there's nickel cycles, there's, you know, there's photoredox, there's single electron, there's electrochemistry. I mean, this is stuff that was just not even on the radar back then. And just,
well, Scott, was palladium discovered back in 1987?
you know, I think it was a great palladium rush of 1987. No, the only 1987. The only thing I remember discovering was Guns N' Roses.
What are you most proud of in terms of your career?
I mean, personally, there's a few things. Getting to a point where somebody once said that, you know, we're not going to have any BS lab heads. I mean, I think that I took that as a challenge, and you know,
somebody said
this was years ago. So Yeah, this was, I mean, way, way back in the early career. And and here we are. We actually have, I don't know, four or five in Groton, two in my department, myself and another guy. And yeah, they're all over in Pfizer now. And I think it's a big step. Part of that is because we hadn't hired everybody who's there as a BS has been there for quite a long time. And so we've got a lot of experience in that cohort. So I think that's probably just being able to get to a point that was probably for me a big accomplishment. I think some of the things I really like are putting out papers. I really like doing. I've had some wonderful collaborations with professors from all over the world. I really, you know, some of that stuff is, you know, I'm proud of. But I think one thing I mentioned earlier, I'm a big, huge fan of process chemistry. My top number one goal beyond, you know, actually getting a drug to market is to never be the before slide in a process talk. So
nice.
In Discovery Chemistry, we work all the way up to where we hand off to the process folks. And we're working up to, you know, 300, 500 gram quantities of stuff that we're delivering. And I don't want them to have to change anything. So some, you know, there's a couple of compounds that we put forward where the route that we gave them was used for, you know, tens of kilos in development. Yeah. You know, at some point, they all get changed eventually. But that's probably, you know, the thing that makes me excited the most was when somebody says, yeah, we'll take that. Thank you. And there's an excitement. And in chemistry, where you're doing something new. And I think that's what, you know, I've been able to do that for a really long time. And so that's what keeps me going.
That's awesome.
So I have kind of a follow-on question that stems from one of our conversations with Derek Lowe. Scott, you have quite a number of patents and stuff. So in terms of just broad creativity, and thinking, you know, coming up with new things, new targets, new routes. What is your approach to creativity? There's a lot of different ways to ask this question, but like, what is your thinking routine? Over time, what has that looked like for you?
Oh, for me, I've got a card catalog of all the things that I've seen, you know, and you know, over the years, you've seen so many different transformations or structures, or you know, when you see something like this, it's going to behave like this. You know, at least in a flask. I can't speak to, you know, inside somebody, but and so, you know, sometimes it's just give me a whiteboard and see what happens. You know, can we break this bond? Can we break that bond? You know, and everything's an evolution. There's always that the first time you sit down, you think about something, you're like, we're going to go this way. And within, you know, maybe just draw it up the board and you realize, yeah, that's a dead end, you know, and it really is. It's and that I think is actually the most fun part of the job is actually trying to figure out what it is that you're going to do and where you're going to start. I actually, my boss sometimes gets on me because I have too many possible ideas, and you know, trying to say which is the one that you're going to go with is the important. Like I said before, it's just, you know, my training at chemistry was just seeing and doing, you know, as opposed to how are things supposed to be. Not everybody, you know, seen things, you know, different combinations of things that other people might not have seen before, and just kind of just, all right, let's give it a shot.
One more creativity questions. Where do your best thoughts come? Do they come while you're in the moment at the whiteboard, or is it 2 a.m.? Is it in the shower? It's while you're on your bike.
You hit two or three of them. Yeah, I would say probably. You know, there's a lot of times when I'll, you know, I come home at night, and I'll be thinking about something, and then yeah, be in the morning, be in the shower or something. It's like, boom, there it was. Or I'll be on the bike on the way in. And I know, Alex, you know this. Sometimes a bike is just such a zen thing. You know, you're concentrating on the traffic, making sure you're trying to keep your balance and looking out for, you know, who knows what. And it's actually kind of mind clearing. And you just, like, next thing you know, pull in the parking spot. I'm like, oh, I know what to do. And I think, you know, the other one is mowing the lawn, you know, just kind of out there. For some reason, I have just a decent amount of good ideas come from just kind of like just wandering around my yard, you know.
Do you have a big yard?
No, I actually don't. I think I maybe, I don't know, a third of an acre or so. And but we got a huge garden that takes up half the yard. So the mowing doesn't take that long. But
and a very rapid creative process.
Yeah, I guess so.
I've got to say, when I got myself an attachment for my helmet that, you know, put the speakers in, I could listen to radio and have Bluetooth phone calls, I realized that, like, something that I lost was that kind of, not quiet zen, because, like, obviously there's all the road noise and whatnot, but, like, it was a time for my brain to wander in the same way that it does, like, you know, in the shower. There aren't too many times in this day and age where you can, like, have nothing going on in your head and let things happen.
Yeah, it's just the road noise. It's almost soothing, you know, and it's a great time to just kind of reflect on something. Sometimes I'll get on the bike and say, I want to do a couple, you know, I'm thinking about something and I don't even realize I'm thinking about it. And I get to work and, you know, there's a thought, you know, we'll give that shot today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, you know what? I think it was Mike Kraut, coming back to him, like when, you know, he was a grumpy sixth year grad student, and I was like an eager first year in the Stoltz lab. And he said, you know, one of his favorite things in lab was running columns. And I think, you know, a lot of it was just like the magic of taking something really, you know, some dirty mixture and bringing out something really clean and pure. But if I remember correctly, it was also, he said it was a great time to just be thinking about chemistry. Maybe I'm just making that part up. But
no, I totally relate to that, because we, you know, we have all the automated biotage things, you know, now, and you throw your column on there and you go off and you do something else. But for a long time, you know, we had the high pressure, air pressure columns, the glass ones that you packed yourselves, or the sort of 30 PSI biotage systems, and where you run through a liter of solvent or something like that. And, you know, maybe it only took 10 minutes or so, but it was that sort of quiet time where you could just think while you're just watching the fractions fill up and moving them by hand, and just reflect on what it is that you're doing, what you're going to do next. Again, like you said, these days there's so many distractions. I mean, sometimes that quiet time is just exactly what you need to sort of just dump everything and get yourself back on track. And I know right now it's just not, you know, because of the milkshake, there's a lot of people going, you know, there's a lot of things on everybody's mind these days that, you know, sometimes it's good to just get out there and mow the lawn, or, you know, do whatever it is that you do to decompress and kind of think about stuff and hopefully stay healthy, you know?
Yep.
Right on. And I think that's a really good point to end on. And so I think now's a good chance to thank you, Scott, for taking some of your Saturday afternoon to talk with us. And I hope you make the best of this milkshake, and wishing everyone health and happiness throughout.
Yeah, thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. And big thanks for everybody who's going to listen. And hope everybody's safe, healthy, and best wishes to family, friends, colleagues, and everybody out there.
Thanks again to Scott. You can follow him on Twitter at BagFoss. Thanks also to Brandon Burkett for designing our logo. You can follow him at ChemScrapes, and to Caroline Landau for coining our podcast title. Please follow us on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you choose. Don't forget to rate and review our podcast, and feel free to leave us your feedback on Twitter at Periodic Bagel. This episode was brought to you by the letter G and the number 16, and I'm not sure why that is, but thank you for joining us, and we will talk to you again next time.
Thanks, Alex.
Oh, man.